Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to London and speak with Hussein Mahmoud, who is the United Kingdom's director of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq and the co-founder of the Iraq Freedom Congress. We'll be talking to her about the Iraqi constitution that appears that it will be delayed for yet another week. And also the Iraqi Sunnis are urging the United States and the United Nations to block the draft. We'll be looking into the extent to which the United States has backed down on Islamic law and women's rights. And we'll be talking to Hussein Mahmoud in a moment. And we'll also talk with James Howard Kunstler. He's the author of what is considered to be a breakthrough book, The Geography of Nowhere and Home from Nowhere, and his latest book, The Long Emergency, Surviving the End of the Oil Age, Climate Change, and Other Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Centuries, offers an alarming vision of post-oil future. And we're looking into both the apocalyptic scenarios and the inevitability of moving away from the carbon economy, perhaps into another economy, maybe the hydrogen part of the molecule. So we'll be talking to James Howard Kunstler in the context of the recent passage of the highway bill and the energy bill, neither of which address any of the present or let alone future problems. We'll also speak with Dr. William Martin, who's a senior fellow for religion and public policy at the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University. He is the author of the definitive With God on Our, on Their Side, The Rise of the Religious Right in America. We'll be looking into whether or not the religious right has peaked in terms of its political effectiveness, although obviously the extent to which recently the so-called Reverend Pat Robinson called upon the faithful to pray to either bring about the death of the Supreme Court Justice or the removal of the Supreme Court Justice. I'll be looking into the role of the religious right in terms of the choice of not just the present nominee for the Supreme Court, but an obviously future replacement for the Chief Justice who is ailing. I'm now speaking with Hussein Mahmoud, who is in the United Kingdom, where she is the director of the United Kingdom's Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq and the co-founder of the Iraqi Freedom Congress. And just in terms of where we stand with the new constitution in Iraq, it appears that it's likely that they'll ask for another week's extension, missing the deadline Monday night for a second time. And there's also, apparently, the Iraqi Sunnis are urging the United States and the United Nations to block the draft of the Constitution, feeling that they have been left out, where the Sunni and where the Shia and the Kurdish delegates have been cutting deals on the side without them. What is your sense about whether or not? Let me begin with just the general question: is who are these people that are talking, that are meeting and drafting this constitution? Do they in any way represent the Iraqi people?
Well, in reality, no. These are just another people who have been chosen on the basis of religious beliefs, religious sects, and tribal backgrounds, as well as ethnic backgrounds, such as Kurdish people or Sunnis or Shiites, and they are all have been chosen by the already existing political parties in the Iraqi National Assembly, the so-called parliament, really, who have nothing to do with real representation of the majority of Iraqi people.
Then, what does that say about the election that brought them to this position?
Well, the election itself was a procedure to legitimize the current regime, and I don't really see that election as a fair election or a legitimate election, because it was carried out under the occupation. It was carried out at the time that the whole society is being terrorized by Islamic groups, by various groups who are really beheading women, killing women, terrorizing ordinary innocent people. Among suicide bombings and suicide attacks, how could a real election could be carried out? And let alone all these religious fatwas by people like Sistani and Shia political parties already in power and other political groups who were threatening ordinary people if they don't go for vote, their food ration would be cut, and then they'll and many other things really that contributed to the election. I mean, this constitution is the second step of the same procedure to legitimize this current installed government, but in reality nothing can give them legitimacy, nothing can give them an image that they are accountable state who are actually acting for the benefit of Iraqi people. They are not. They're just being, installed there against the will of Iraqi people out of nothing, and they are just carrying out U.S. politics and U.S. interest in Iraq. That's all they are there for.
And how can we measure the will of the Iraqi people?
Well, because you can see the anger and revolt both against the occupation and against this current regime. I mean, they have just after 1 or 2 months of their installment, they started cutting on, attacking workers' rights, attacking, they cut food rations from the Iraqi people. They are not restoring even the most basic services such as, electricity and water supply. I mean, people are really being surrounded by all these various forces. And among that, they have no rights, they have no protection, they have no basic security measurements. Of course, Iraqi people don't want to live like that. I mean, it's been 2.5 years of the occupation and of this current regime that is being there. I mean, they are just having, they have created palaces and nice offices for themselves in Green Zone, in Baghdad. They protect themselves while they're heavily engaged in corruption. And the whole society is being left alone without anything, without any protection, without any kind of, living or any kind of standard that, the most basic standards, basically, for a human being to have food, clothes, and to have somewhere to live in. I mean, most of Iraqi society don't have those things. I mean, how can we actually look at them as legitimate? How can we accept them? And how can we accept occupation that have turned our society into a battlefield, basically?
So, Hussein Mahmoud, then, obviously, there's no way that you can rebuild Iraq without establishing security. And the United States is arguing or suggesting that they are in the process of as President Bush says, when we'll stand down when the Iraqis stand up. And they keep, Rumsfeld and Bush keep referring to the new Iraqi army and the Iraqi police. They keep giving numbers. Apparently 90%+ of these people are Shiite and Kurds. They don't really represent Iraq. But it begs the basic question, is that if an ill-trained, hastily put together Iraqi army and police, how could they defeat an insurgency that the best army in the world, the United States Army and Marines, can't defeat? So what do you think the chances are of this new Iraqi army establishing any kind of order?
Well, I don't think they can establish any kind of order, because looking at the government itself is one of the causes of the whole chaos. They are part of the chaos. They are being brought by the US and UK and the government and being installed there. So the reality is the occupation, with all these problems that have given rise to political Islam in Iraq and that has given power to these political groups to be in power, actually, this is all part of the chaos, this is all part of the occupation environment, and it all has to end, basically. Otherwise, having army will not solve any problems, really, because the terrorization is going on. They have their excuse that Iraq is an occupied country, it's a Muslim land, so we have to liberate it. They have this so-called excuse to terrorize us, so they can't really do anything. I mean, Islamists are going to kill people in the public, and the security forces are watching them because they are not basically bothered to protect the ordinary Iraqis. They just want to save themselves. It's the same thing with the U.S. and the occupying armies. They just really are within their own bases. They just want to, you know, be safe, and they don't care what's going on in Iraq. If ordinary people are suffering, if they don't have security, they don't look at it as this is their task, basically, to at least contribute to the security measurements. They don't care.
Well, you can't blame the American soldiers for this government has put them into harm's way without explaining what they're doing there, what the mission is. The government itself, the Bush administration, have never had a consistent or coherent reason for going into war. They keep changing it. 1 minute it's WMD, the next minute it's bringing democracy, getting rid of a dictator, securing democracy and freedom in the Middle East. It just changes all the time. And the military leadership are clearly unhappy with the situation, and they are leaking stories about trying to pull out, and they want to change the definition of the war on terror. So then Bush has to keep contradicting them. So in effect, there's a kind of revolt going on at the very highest levels of the United States military in terms of this mission that they want to get out of. But again, the question that everybody asks is that obviously we can't win this war, but many people say we can't afford to lose it. We can't afford to leave that country in chaos. So what is your solution?
Well, my solution is basically I am calling for the immediate end of the occupation, because in reality the occupation is like a magnet for bringing all these terrorist networks into Iraq, such as Al-Qaeda, such as Zarqawi, and various other sources from Iran, from Saudi Arabia. All these neighboring countries have a very upper hand on the situation on the ground at the moment. And before, I mean, 2 years and a half ago, we didn't have all these terrorist networks inside Iraq. How come suddenly all these things appear in one go? I mean, it's all because of the occupation. As long as the occupation goes on in Iraq, the situation will get even worse. So the immediate end of the occupation is one of the major solutions for the problem, and that the international community should really play an important role here. I mean, the people who oppose the war, the people who are opposed to the occupation, they have to, you know, ally with secular progressive forces in Iraq, with workers' movement, with women's movement, student movement, to actually support them, to strengthen them in their struggle to end the occupation as well as Islamism in Iraq. Therefore, we have founded Iraq Freedom Congress recently, which is an initiative being put forward by various organizations on the ground who are against the occupation, who are against the political Islamists. We want to end this misery, basically, and return the civil society, return the social fabric, and return the power to people. I mean, people should really have a say in all this, what's going on. At the moment, everything is being decided like before. I mean, during Saddam's time, we had no say. We had no say in anything. It's the same at the moment. We have no say. We have no control on what's going on. And that's why it's really dangerous times. And it only could be solved by us on the ground, the secular progressive people, as well as the people across the world who really want to support us, who really want to see Iraq being freed, being, you know, enjoying peace and freedom on the ground. And that could only be done in this international initiative, which is Iraq Freedom Congress, IFC, basically. And I call upon everybody who wants to make a difference in Iraq, you know, to join us and to be part of this liberating movement inside Iraq.
And Hussein Mahmoud, what kind of numbers do you think there are in terms of the secular progressives inside Iraq, given that the two dominant factions now that are basically negotiating this new constitution are the Shiites, who seem to be basically led by Ayatollah Sistani, who's actually an Iranian, and he seems to be able to basically, with one voice, speak for them. And the Kurds, who are two rival kind of mafias that have basically been have had autonomy for some time, and they're not even sure they want to join in the new Iraq. Give me a sense of what your numbers are.
Well, basically, we are we have a strong women's movement, strong workers' movement, as well as student movement. I mean, in the same place that you say, for example, Basra, it's supposed to be highly dominated by Shias, by Muqtada Sadr. There has been a huge student protest, demonstration, and strike for 5 days. Thousands of university students, as well as high school students, joined by the secular people of Basra, they had the biggest demonstration ever in that city, and against Muqtada Sadr, against his attack on the student outing in the one of the city's major parks. I mean, you know, when it comes to that, the numbers are huge, the movement is going on, but the reality is, because we are not brutal, we are not beheading people, we are not terrorizing our society, we just want to recruit and mobilize and organize the masses, and through social and political struggle, and also to be able to defend ourselves against all these dark forces. And the reality is, I just want to give you one example about the Kurdish issue. Now, at the moment, Kurdish people in northern Iraq, they want secular constitution and secular state, as well as they are against calling Iraq an Arab country or Shia or Islamic and something. But the Kurdish nationalist parties, they've always been compromising the Kurdish people's rights, you know, with Saddam's regime, and now with this current regime. They are really dealing on the back of Iraqi Kurdish people. I mean, a lot of people in Kurdistan are not happy with them. They are actually saying that if there is an Islamic state in Iraq, we will be calling for independence of Kurdistan. I mean, that's what the people in Kurdistan are saying. They don't want to be part of a religious state. So there is a huge secular trend within Iraqi society, and we have never been under an Islamic state. We've never had Sharia law in place in its brutality. Okay, Saddam's regime was brutal as a dictator. This is all, you know, very clear for everybody, but we've never had to wear the veil. We've never had to basically be accompanied by our brothers and fathers to go to the street. I mean, this is the first time it's happening, actually, in our time. I mean, I lived all my life there, and it's just chaotic what is being created. It's really terrible. It's really dark. And as I said, the only hope is in us, in our movement, in our Iraq Freedom Congress. Otherwise, I really don't see any other solution with this current installed regime or with the occupation. There's no way. There's no solution with them.
Well, just to quote from a Kurdish politician who is in this negotiation, he says, "We understand the Americans have sided with the Shiites. It's shocking. It doesn't fit American values. They have spent so much blood and money here only to back the creation of an Islamic state. I can't believe that that's what the Americans really want and what American people want." Now, you just got through talking about Muqtada Sadr down in Basra. He apparently was also responsible for the killing of the American reporter. He's being run by the Iranian National Revolutionary Guards as a surrogate for the hardliners in Tehran. And you mentioned earlier the suicide bombers coming in from Saudi Arabia. So it does seem to in many ways that Iraq has become a sort of surrogate war, a battleground for the states in the region. Just in closing, how do you, without guns, and you're calling for the Americans to pull out, and the so-called wisdom here is if America pulls out, there'll be a bloodbath and a civil war. So just walk us through the consequences of an American withdrawal, and how you, representing the secular and progressive forces, could rise out of the chaos and stop this agony.
Well, basically, we are you know, trying to create people's houses in every neighborhood, in every district, for people to organize, to run their own lives, to restore civil, you know, social fabric into the society. But at the same time, they have to be armed to defend themselves for a self-defense, because it's a fact. When I was in Iraq 3-4 months ago, I couldn't go out without a bodyguard, an armed bodyguard. It's the reality. I mean, it's a chaos. Guns are everywhere. They can kill anybody at any time they want. No one is responsible for it. No one is, you know, investigating any crimes at the moment in Iraq. So that's why we call for our movement, you know, to basically have arms to defend themselves, not to go and behead people, not to go and terrorize others or to impose anything on anybody. But it's one way. It's one of the ways, basically, to protect yourself if Islamists come to terrorize you, to kill you, to behead you, so you have something to defend yourself. And it's really a rule of a jungle at the moment, unfortunately, in Iraq. Mm. If you are not armed, you will be easily beheaded and killed or kidnapped. So that's one of the dark and the bitter realities we have to face with. And therefore, through Iraq Freedom Congress, we really want to mobilize the masses. I mean, women, students, progressive, secular, and socialists, and all these progressive forces in Iraq, just to end this miserable situation, just to return the power to the people, to be able to run their own lives, to be able to choose their own representatives. And it's not an easy task, but we have to do our part as well. We have to change this dark reality. And I think, you know, movements across, along the history have been, you know, for the rights of women, for the rights of workers. Sometimes there are defeats, sometimes there are rises as well. So I hope that with international solidarity, we will be able to put an end to all these miseries and for a better situation for freedom and real equality, and that people should be treated with dignity, with respect, you know, with equality, regardless of their gender, religious sects, and all this nonsense division that has already been going on in Iraq.
So basically what you're saying is that the United States should pull out. That would take away the excuse that these Islamic gangsters have, like Zakawi and Muqtada Sadr, to kill the people, and they would be therefore isolated, and the people will rise up and get rid of these Islamic fascists.
Yeah, sure. That's what we are struggling for at the moment.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye, and good luck.
Bye. Thank you.
Hello again, Amy and Masters. Just speaking then with Huzan Mahmoud, who is the United Kingdom's director of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq and the co-founder of the Iraqi Freedom Congress. And we're talking about the new constitution and the extent to which the United States has backed down on the issues of Islamic law and women's rights in the new constitution that the Sunnis have just urged the United States and the United Nations to block this draft because it favors the dominant Shia and Kurdish factions. I'm now speaking with James Howard Kunstler, who is the author of what are considered two classics of sociological commentary, The Geography of Nowhere and Home from Nowhere. And his latest book is The Long Emergency, Surviving the End of the Oil Age, Climate Change, and Other Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. And James Howard Kunstler, just a week or so ago, the Congress and the passed and the President signed two bills which were much touted by the administration, the Highway Bill and the Energy Bill, neither of which in any way address the problems that you say are not so much coming down the pike, but they are really, it's really kind of a freight train that's heading to us, towards us at breakneck speed.
Yes, we are already in the zone of the long emergency, as I call it.
Sounds like you've got an emergency on your hand there with the dog.
I'm sorry about that. We are heading into a period of serious hardship, and our leaders are doing practically nothing. One of the things that I think that shows how unserious we are is the fact that none of our leaders are talking about restoring the American passenger rail system. Something that would make a huge difference in our oil consumption, and that tells us something about where we're at.
Well, you know, here in Los Angeles, they used to have a light rail system that was quite ubiquitous, and there's in fact a movie called Roger Rabbit, which the plot of which is that a cabal gets together to take down the light rail system in order to sell cars, gasoline, and tires, and it's exactly what happened. So we've already had an experience here where we had something that was taken away, and of course today we desperately need something to replace it. Every day in Los Angeles, people spend hours in gridlock, burning up gasoline and going nowhere, and our political leaders don't even talk about it. I mean, it's not...
Well, the dirty secret of the American economy now is that it has come to be based on the creation of suburban sprawl and its accessories and the activities associated with it, like real estate sales and the spinning off of tradable debt instruments from mortgages.
You mean the housing bubble, in other words?
In other words, the housing bubble, and it occupies about 43% of the American economy now. If you subtract the housing bubble and all of its associated activities, and all of the car-dependent activities associated with it, there's not a whole lot left besides fried chicken and open-heart surgery. And so none of our political leaders really want to tell the American people the truth, which is that we are spending all of our national wealth on the infrastructure for daily life that has no future, on a way of living that has no future. So it represents a tremendous and continuing misallocation of resources, but it happens, unfortunately, to be now the foundation of our economy. So we're gonna probably become a lot more delusional yet before we really start paying attention to what's happening.
So you're saying, James Howard, Councillor, that it's not just the fact that we're running out of oil at the macro level. The way that we've organized our societies in this urban sprawl that continually gobbles up farmland and spreads out from the center is a dysfunctional way of living. Now, what would you replace this with?
Well, it's going to be very hard to just replace it. You know, we're going to go through a transition period that is going to be very, very difficult. And part of it will involve the devaluation of the suburban fabric that exists. One of the huge problems that will be associated with this long emergency, as I call it, will be the fact that we're going to see the demise of industrial-style agriculture. And we're going to have to grow a lot more food close to home. Now, obviously, there are parts of the country that are better suited to that than others, and some that are not at all going to be able to do that. I have said in my book that places like Phoenix and Las Vegas may dry up and blow away. I certainly think they will become substantially depopulated. And it's certainly ironic that Las Vegas is often touted nowadays as the city of the future, because it's everything but that. It is truly yesterday's tomorrow. But one of the implications of this agricultural predicament we're going to find ourselves in, the difficulty in producing food, is that it will compel us to revalue land and what we do with it, the activities that take place on it. And
now, what will bring about this rural crisis?
Well, we're already in it. What's happening is we are entering a global energy predicament that is not going to go away.
The chemical fertilizers, in other words, will dry up.
Oh, yes. Well, we're going to have it's going to become increasingly expensive and difficult to apply oil-based pesticides and herbicides and gas-based fertilizers on the soil, and to run agriculture at the scale that we're running it now. You know, one of the things we're probably going to have to do is downscale virtually all of our activities, including the way we do retail, you know, the way we conduct commerce in this country. The big box stores' days are numbered. We are going to have to reestablish and restore local economic networks of interdependency and local activity, and we're not prepared to do that at all. We're going to have to, our centralized schools are probably going to fail us, and we're going to have to reorganize that.
Well, as if they're not failing us already.
Well, yeah, they're failing us now in terms of education, but in terms of even the logistics of getting the kids around and servicing these enormous population sheds, as they're called, you know, serviced by the immense fleets of yellow school buses. These things are really not going to work very well for us in the days ahead.
So in many ways, even though this is a dystopian and traumatic scenario, the solutions that you're talking about may strike some people as quite utopian, almost like a new kind of hippie world where people are self-sufficient, they grow their own food, they're much less materialistic, and they're not just choking the planet with useless activity and getting sick on corporate food. But the bottom line, James Howard, Councillor, is that we're so ill-prepared for this dislocation.
Ian, you know, I'm 56 years old, and I lived through the entire age of Aquarius as a young man, but, you know, I was never a hippie myself, particularly, and this is not a hippie vision. This, you know, the future will present circumstances to us which will require us to behave differently. It's as simple as that. And we will do what we have to do. For the last 10 years or so, there's been a debate about, you know, how we develop land. You know, should it be suburban or should it be new urbanist or some other thing? You know, some of those things are going to be coming off the menu. The suburban way of life is coming off the menu, and it will not be a choice anymore. It'll be simply something that we simply won't be able to do. This is not really a utopian vision. It's a statement of what the future requires of us.
Right. I was thinking of that book actually, Ecotopia. I don't know whether you've read it, but
oh yeah, sure. Yeah. Is it Jack Lessinger?
No, Kallenbeck.
Kallenbeck.
Ennis Kallenbeck, yeah. So, but just on the issue of the trauma, James Howard Councillor, yeah. the notion that we are so ill prepared that the bills that were just passed, the highway bill and the energy bill, might as well been written in the 19th century or the early 20th century for all that they do about the future. And I remember back in the days of Jimmy Carter when there was an oil cutoff. And here in California, they had odd days and even days on your license plate to get gasoline. And you see, I saw grown people weeping because their license plates were odd or even on the wrong day, and they couldn't get gasoline. And so we're just hopelessly addicted.
Well, there are a lot of we have a lot of delusional thinking going on. One of them is that we're going to be rescued by, quote, the marketplace. In fact, you even sort of see that in the cover story of the New York Times magazine today, which is about the beginning of the end of oil, as it's titled. And, you know, there's the idea that alternative energy is going to, or technology will rescue us. Well, one thing that I don't think that we understand is that technology is not energy, and they're not substitutable for one another. They're not interchangeable. Energy is the problem. And, you know, a lot of people assume that the marketplace will just present us with some new thing. The fact is that no alternative form of energy known to us now will allow us to run things the way we are running them, or even a substantial fraction of them. And there's not going to be a hydrogen economy. That was, unfortunately, an overhyped thing. We are probably going to use solar and wind-generated energies, mostly electrical, really, for all practical purposes. But we're not going to run them on a massive basis. We will probably use them on a very local or maybe even a household basis.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, but nothing's being done to stimulate a solar economy. It's as though it's too easy. I mean, they're just going to pour huge money into nuclear. And this chimera of hydrogen, which, you know, the way that the Bush administration is touting it, is actually dirty hydrogen. It comes from coal and oil and nuclear.
Well, it's even sort of beside the point where it comes from, because the fact is that any way you produce hydrogen, you get less energy from the hydrogen than it takes to produce it. So, you know,
unless it's done with passive solar, though, I mean, wouldn't that, if you had great...
No, we are not going to replace what we're doing now with oil and natural gas with solar. Mm-hmm. We will use solar, but it's not going to substitute even a substantial fraction of it. And, you know, another thing that people, I think, do not consider is the fact that we don't even know whether we can fabricate the hardware for this stuff without an underlying cheap oil economy. You know, everybody assumes that we're going to be just fabricating solar panels and turbines for windmills. Well, these things require advanced metallurgy and very sophisticated forms of fabrication and a lot of energy to do it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why everybody assumes that we're going to even have the energy to fabricate the stuff, at least after a certain transitional period. So we're really facing some very, very troubling questions.
There are people like Senator Imhoff, who's the chair of the Senate Energy Committee, who believes that global warming is a hoax. He's one of these born-agains who perhaps has an investment in the end of the world.
Well, Ian, I got to say this right here. You know, yeah. Another thing that I believe the public underestimates is the degree to which the current political establishment, the people now in power, namely the Republican Party, will be discredited by their failure to prepare the American public. And for that matter, you know, the Democratic Party has done a very poor job as well. John Kerry didn't say a word about restoring the passenger railroad system. And we have a railroad system that the Bulgarians would be ashamed of. So all of our political leaders have done a pretty poor job. And, you know, one of the things that unfortunately leaves us open to, vulnerable to, is extremist politics when things really get to be difficult.
Yeah, you've referred in your book, The Long Emergency, Surviving the End of the Oil Age, Climate Change and Other Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century, James Howard Custer, you refer to the portent of corn-pone Nazis?
Well, I think that there, you know, there, we're going to have a very large number of economic losers who are going to be created by this this period we face. And they're going to be sort of the formerly middle class. There are going to be a lot of them. They're going to be full of grievance and resentment and anger and bewilderment about why they have lost their entitlements to the American dream, easy motoring life. And I think that they will probably turn to extremist politicians to try to solve their problems and to bring back the good old days of 1997, which, of course, will be impossible. So, you know, that's something I think we need to be concerned about.
Well, I was what I was about to say earlier about you know, the sort of silver lining, if you will, in this otherwise dark cloud is the notion that we seem to be politically incapable of facing the reality of global warming, and a catastrophic cutoff of oil would be about the only thing that could save the planet from global warming.
Well, my own opinion is that the mechanisms of climate change are already pretty much underway, and there's really not much we can do about it, even if we, I don't think we would, I don't think that any group of nations will follow any set of protocols when it really gets down to it, and that we're pretty much stuck with the things that are underway now.
And how dire are they? Because some scientists say that the melting of the polar ice caps changes the salinity of the ocean and will affect the way that the currents, the Humboldt and the Gulf Streams, etc., operate. And it's, you know, it's, the oceans are like a giant pump, and it'd be almost like a heart slowing down with cholesterol, etc. You know. That's the analogy.
Well, I don't know if that's quite the analogy. I would say that, you know, it would certainly change the way that our weather systems now move. You know, there will certainly be plenty of weather left in the planet Earth, but, you know, places that have enjoyed favorable climates for growing crops, for example, may find themselves turning into desert. Places like Northern Europe, which have enjoyed favorable warm currents at high latitudes, may find themselves growing a lot colder, so it could be very bad news for the people who live in Northern Europe. And as we've seen from the record of the Greenland ice cores, these, even before the age that human beings were burning coal and oil, climate change often overtook the Earth very, very suddenly, you know, within a matter of a decade. So, you know, we're facing natural cycles as well as our own contribution to it, which has probably accelerated the problem.
Well, given this prognosis, James Howard Kunstler, it would seem that people who wake up and are not in denial, and clearly there's no political courage to lead us out of this, you know, this catastrophe we're heading towards. So individuals then have to start making these life choices for themselves, and those that do it earlier will be the winners, and those that are continually, you know, waiting in line for gas, paying, you know, $10 to, you know, up to $100 a gallon, are going to be the losers. So, what steps should we take now?
Well, a lot of these things involve individual choices. You know, it remains to be seen whether the public or their leaders, in aggregate, will begin making intelligent responses to these problems. Individuals can decide, of course, to move to Phoenix or to move to some other place that maybe have better prospects for the future. You know, you can move to Las Vegas or maybe move to Michigan. People have to make vocational choices. There will be far fewer jobs for public relations executives and probably a great many more people working in agriculture. I personally think that agriculture is going to come closer to the center of American life in a way that we haven't seen for many generations. But, you know, I think that the project of civilization is not going to go away overnight. And I also think that the American people have historically been brave and honest and generous and hopeful, and that they will find some way to reclaim those parts of our national character to meet these challenges.
But the bottom line is we're going to have to change from consumers to conservationists.
Well, consuming and the blue light shopping fiesta, the blue light special shopping fiesta that has become the American way of life for the last 20 years is going to become a thing of the past. You know, shopping and consuming will fade further back into the background of our lives, and we will be paying attention to other things. I think we'll be working more closely, shoulder to shoulder, with our neighbors on things that really matter, not just on sitting in cubicles moving pixels around on a screen. So,
but we also should be installing solar while we can, and trying to make ourselves energy self-sufficient in every little way. But what about the earlier point that you made, James Howard Kunstler, is that 40%+ of our economy is tied up in this sort of illusion of suburban bliss, where people are having to commute hours a day back and forth from suburbia. And that, as President Bush tries to tell us regularly, today people own more homes than ever in America's history. Well, what he doesn't tell us is they own less of their homes. The banks own more. So
yeah.
What?
You can either rent a house or rent the money to own one.
Right. So what's going to happen then in terms of the housing bubble? People suddenly, everybody on variable mortgages being out in the cold, a huge glut of real estate. I mean, again, I don't think people are prepared for that kind of trauma.
Well, personally, I think that the end of the housing bubble is indeed going to be very ugly. What many commentators and observers overlook, I think, is the amount of turbulence that we are going to face. And I think it will express itself in population movements, of people leaving some regions of the country and moving to others. It will express itself in wild losses of wealth and the devaluation of suburban property of all kinds, and the desperation of people trying to get rid of it and get out of it.
And what will they get into, though?
Well,
where are they going to live?
That's why I say it will be a very turbulent period, because these choices are going to be very difficult. I do think, for instance, that we're going to see a reversal of the 200-year trend of people moving from the countryside to the cities. I think what we will see instead is people moving from the cities to smaller towns and indeed to places that support agriculture. I happen to believe that our larger cities are probably going to contract and that the process is apt to be very painful. And they may actually contract as they densify at their centers, which might sound paradoxical, but it means that a lot of those asteroid belts of suburbs and semi-suburbs and exurbs are going to be the places that are in trouble.
Mm-hmm. There's one model that we might look at, actually, and I think we're going to have to bring you back if we can, James Howard Kunstler, for a more extended interview. The Cubans actually lost oil overnight when the Soviets cut them loose.
Yes, it's a very interesting example, and of course people point to Bill McKibben's article in Harper's a few months ago about how they made that transition.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cubans indeed had to make a very sudden transition between a subsidized oil economy from the Russians to something quite different. And one of the things they're now doing is that, they've changed the whole collective farm system. They've broken it up into smaller farms that are privately owned, and they're using tremendous numbers of oxen and mules now to work the land rather than tractors. But I would add this about experience, that the Cuban experience occurred against the background of a world that was still very stable. It will be very different for the advanced cultures of the world when they all find themselves in trouble with oil and natural gas, and they're no longer in a peaceful world. They will find themselves in a turbulent world where there's a lot of where there are military contests over the remaining oil. And, you know, it's going to be a different experience for us.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, James Howard, Councillor.
Pleasure, Ian.
Bye-bye. Bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking there with James Howard, Councillor, who's the author of The Long Emergency, Surviving the End of the Oil Age, Climate Change, and Other Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. I'm now speaking with Dr. William Rice, who is a Senior Fellow for Religion and Public Policy at the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University, and he's the author of With God on Their Side, The Rise of the Religious Right in America. And that's a PBS series of the same name was produced, and I believe it's going to be shown again. Dr. Martin graduated from the Harvard Divinity School in 1963 and received his PhD from Harvard in 1969. He's been teaching at Rice University for some time, and he's updated edition of the book With God on Our Side has just been released, and the updated PBS the version of the PBS documentary series will be released on DVD in September. Just not so long ago, Dr. Martin, Pat Robinson, the televangelist, called upon his faithful to pray for the justices on the Supreme Court to either die or retire, and it does seem that God has answered Pat Robinson's prayers.
Well, he had the odds in his favor. You're working with people over 80 years old. Pat Robertson has been given over many years to say some things that are pretty extreme and outlandish, and sometimes he's an embarrassment to the people that also value him on other counts.
Well, another little sort of extraordinary outburst happened recently in a church, one of those mega churches down in Houston, where Tom DeLay's district, he was at his local church, and the minister said that the gateway to Armageddon has already been opened by the war in Iraq, to which Tom DeLay said, "Amen, I have just witnessed the word of God being spoken."
Yes, well, this represents a particular theology that is now becoming better known to people as a result of the enormous popularity of the Left Behind series of novels, which have been sold second only to Harry Potter and have sold 60 million copies and more. And this set of novels is a novelization of a theology that has to do with the end of the world, with the second coming of Jesus, the rapture, and things like that. But the key aspect of this, and it's too complicated to go into in detail here, but the key aspect is that for Jesus to be able to come back, Israel needs to be in charge of all of the land, including Judea and Samaria or the West Bank. So this means that conservative Christians who subscribe to this theology, and not all conservative Christians do, but the main force of the religious right does, they believe that Israel has to be in charge of all the land, and therefore the Palestinians have to leave or be in subjection. And last year, in 2004, early January, when Tom DeLay was in Israel, he said, at the time when the president was being talked about the roadmap, he said, "This is unacceptable. We cannot have a two-state solution, because God gave all of the land to the Israelites." And many people who are supporters, who are part of the religious right, and supporters of a large number of Congress people, members of Congress in both houses, believe this quite strongly. Obviously, the president's not taking that line.
Well, it's worth noting that there were Christian evangelicals or fundamentalists from the United States demonstrating with hardline settlers. Actually, not even the settlers are demonstrating so much against the Gaza withdrawal. They're the Kuk Party, the Kahana people, and other right-wing extremists. But they are being joined by delegations of fundamentalists from here in the United States. So there is this strange compact between the Israeli right and the American right. And, of course, in this mix, the Jews get used. They're merely the instruments to bring about the end of the world. And I believe there's that dispensation that only 144,000 of them have to convert at the last minute before the rest of us burn in hell.
That's correct. So it is. But on the other hand, many Israelis, secular and religious, are quite aware of this and believe that they are also using the fundamentalists to gain support for their views in the United States. I was on a program in Philadelphia last year, and an older Jewish scholar was there, and he was asked about how does Israel justify taking the support of these people who believe, just what you said, that most Jews will ultimately be destroyed. And he just smiled and said, "We take our chances."
Well, it's strange bedfellows. If I were Jewish, I'd be extremely embarrassed to have these people in my corner. But that's another matter.
Many are.
What about though? Just a general question, Dr. William Martin, because we've discussed this phenomenon for some time, for years now, and it's, I think people are only starting to realize with the first election, not that the president was elected in any meaningful way the first time around, but then the second time around, again, there's some doubts about the legality of it, but the long and the short of it is that the Christian coalition delivered 3.5 million extra votes from the last time around. And there's a belief that they're, in ascendancy. And, of course, there's been some quid pro quo with the faith-based funding, et cetera. Do you think that they've peaked, though, in terms of their – because much of what they support, at the end of the day, they're going to – in the red states, they're going to end up with worse Medicare – no ability to sue, and onerous conditions when they go bankrupt, and this war that they've touted so much in Iraq is going to hell in a handbasket. So, is there any way that reality is going to impinge upon the born-agains?
Well, of course, it's possible, and Thomas Franks has written about this with his book about what's the title? What Happened to Kansas? Or the fact that many people are voting against their own interests here. The answer to that, of course, would be that they feel that these economic and social values are not as important to them, or they're not as important to them as what they consider to be the moral values, and so they.
But they will get.
In part, I think haven't done the numbers.
Right, but they may well get there. I think where Thomas Franks got it wrong, he said that the corporatists who control the Republican Party manipulate the evangelicals with these social issues, but they never intend to solve them. Now, in other words, they never intend to ban abortion. They want to keep it going around as an irritant in order to organize their grassroots. But it looks as if with the ascendancy of Judge Thomas, if he's confirmed, which seems to be pretty likely.
Judge Roberts,
I mean. Yeah. So he'll be confirmed, which is pretty likely, that they will overturn Roe v. Wade. They won't so much take it on frontally, but they'll kick it back to the states. So, this is, again, I think it'll be a long learning curve, won't it? We'll have the red states and the blue state divide much greater. Young women in the red states will be taking Greyhound buses to get abortions in the blue states.
Well, something like that is possible. Whether or not Roe v. Wade will be overturned, I think that's not a certainty. But in any case, when you look at the red and blue states, or I'm sure you have seen maps too, which show that they are in many respects purple. that the lines are not all that. You can say which states are going to go red and which are going to go blue, but when you look within those states, it's not all that sharp. And I think a number of people ultimately will say that this is not what we wanted. But people have been saying, whatever happened to the religious right? Haven't they lost their clout since 1980? And in fact, they continue to grow and to gain power. So one thinks that perhaps they are going to overreach. And I think you saw a little bit of that, for example, with the Terri Schiavo case. Mm-hmm. And many people said, "Oh, come on! You're just using this as an attention grabber." And we believe that the medical situation doesn't justify this. So there is certainly the possibility of overreaching. But as you said, it looks like it's going to be a long learning curve.
Well, let's just, in closing, then, Dr. William Martin. It seems to me that the only way to blunt the religious right is to expose their the angry, hateful kind of nature of much of it is just Tom Paine said, one of the intellectual founding fathers of this country, that belief in a cruel God makes a cruel man. And it seems to me that we have in this country, in the religious right, the theology of selfishness, this bestseller that the Californian guy has, The Purpose-Driven Life. It's all about selfishness. This is a country that gives the least amongst the industrial countries to the world in terms of charity. This is a country full of overweight people who consume. We just got through talking about the long emergency. So what's your sense about any kind of movement, in a theological movement in this country, redefining the very nature of who the prophet Jesus was and what he had to say?
Well, I think there is some movement. Probably the clearest sign of this has come from the wide attention that a book by Jim Wallis wrote, God's Politics. And Jim Wallis is himself a conservative evangelical who has lived in a community that is very much strongly concerned with the poor and living a simple life. And that book has gained enormous attention from both evangelicals and non-evangelical Christians alike. And he has called for and has gotten, there is a considerable response to this. It's not as well organized, it's not as large, and it doesn't hold sway in the megachurches the way that the more dominant view has held. But there is a recognition that this has gone too far, that this is not exactly, you know, there are 2,000 scriptures or more, 2,000 to 3,000 scriptures that deal with poverty, with injustice, with oppression of the weak, and a small handful that deal with homosexuality. And obviously, there's a great deal more concern with homosexuality among the religious right than it is with what Jesus and the prophets emphasized a great deal more. There's some recognition of that. There is an evangelical movement called Creation Care, which is trying to counter the apparent contempt for the environment.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, Dr. William Martin, but I thank you very much for joining us. It always astounds me that this movement is so powerful and growing, and yet it has so little to do with the biblical prophet.
Well, it does seem to me to be a very strange reading of Scripture.
Again, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking then with Dr. William Martin, who's a Senior Fellow for Religion and Public Policy at the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University, and the author of With God on Their Side, The Rise of the Religious Right in America. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, and the engineer, Jazz Shepherd, and also the assistant producers, Carol Coote and Rusty Wynn. This program and all other previous programs are available at ianmasters.org.